how prescient Dr. King's words were in ways he never expected. The things we think now when we hear about God's children smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society. The new incarnations for his words that he certainly never imagined when he wrote them, nor did we. All this week, thinking about this sermon, I've had this phrase on an infinite loop in my mind, which is frustrating to me because I have never been a Rolling Stones fan. I'm sure I'll hear about that in the line after the service, but... And some of their songs are great, no question, but mostly their sound doesn't really pull me in usually, and also I do not think that, you know, the moves like Jagger are all that, so if you know what I'm saying. But aesthetics aside, this phrase has been on this infinite loop in my mind. I can't get no satisfaction. Now, the original point of that song, as a lot of us already know, was to decry superficiality and personal emptiness. And these days, the refrain is cycling in my mind about very different things, about communal ignorance and selfishness. And it is making me crazy. I decided to write out everything that was echoing for me about this week. From this world and these days, I can't get no satisfaction. From governments and leaders, most especially our own, ignoring climate change and the imperatives of life on this planet in order to double down on posturing and weaponry and death. I can't get no satisfaction from the natural disasters heightened by climate change and the devastation it wreaks everywhere. Whole countries, Zambia, facing the worst famine in decades, and much of the Australian continent in flames. And all those beautiful creatures fleeing and failing and dying. I can't get no satisfaction from the willful renewal on poisonous fuel and the willful rejection of renewable energy. I can't get no satisfaction from the perversity of human nature that chooses the inertia of myths and the comfort of denial over the imperatives of truth and the realities of science. I can't get no satisfaction from the genetic, sociological, evolutionary tribalism that continues to look for the them rather than the us. I can't get no satisfaction from the objectification and neuroses that dog us all about restrictions around identity and acceptability and dignity. I can't get no satisfaction from the conservatives who will not acknowledge or condemn race prejudice and all it does to jeopardize and undermine and end beautiful human lives and souls. I can't get no satisfaction from the progressives who speak with contempt about all white people, including fellow progressive white people. I can't get no satisfaction. Every day another weight is added to the burden, and again and again, I can't get no satisfaction. And once I was finished writing it out, I thought, well, that was helpful. It actually was, because, of course, I don't have to be satisfied. I don't have to be satisfied. What I have to do, what I think we have to do, is to make sure we are doing something with our, and it is, you know, an understatement, dissatisfaction. And this anniversary reminds us every year when we are looking for hope and channels for our dissatisfaction that we can turn to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He was certainly profoundly dissatisfied. Though he was a man of gifts and blessings, and he could have just taken that and run, you know? And it wasn't nearly enough for him. He wasn't willing to merely look out for himself and his family. That wasn't enough for his people and his world and his time. The Stone Song came out a couple of years after Dr. King talked about maladjustment at Western Michigan. 3 years before he was assassinated in Memphis, and smack in the middle of that decade of great tumult and a lot of maladjustment and dissatisfaction. And his maladjustment is always going to be a lesson for all of us who could also content ourselves with our gifts and our blessings, whatever they are. Because we also have to do more than that. And we hold Dr. King as a beacon and a teacher. We shared his dream, many of us, marched with him decades ago. He gave the Honored Wear lecture at the Unitarian Universalist Assembly, General Assembly in 1965. We too were his disciples and adherents. And we still believe in his dream, and we are so not satisfied. The American dream is an individualist dream, right? Each person pulls themselves up by their bootstraps. It's an individualist ideal. It has community implications if it works for everybody, but that's not its core. And this nation is always torn between those two poles of the one and the many, me and you. Any one can be president, as we are certainly seeing now. But while America is fundamentally an individualist society in so many ways, we do also know the truth of that African proverb from Tanzania and Zanzibar that it takes a village to raise a child. And the issue we're struggling with now as a nation isn't about really the necessity of community. It's about the nature of community. What kind of village should raise the child? Right? And what kind of child will the village raise? And a lot of churches are losing people in droves here in the U.S. because the congregations seem out of touch at best and downright hypocritical at worst. And still people long for community, for village. And they find it in new ways. They start new groups, or they meet in coffee houses, or they do it on social media, right? Which is the most obvious thing, this ginormous community that is the Twitterverse, where you get to know and stay in touch with literally countless people, and where the gossip and judgment of a village is replaced by the gossip and judgment of the world. It's the exact same dynamic, just writ incredibly large. And instead of watching at windows or talking at the kitchen table or the cafe in the center of town or the pub, we just tap our phones or log into our email. And as with villages, a lot of the dynamics around social media are troubling when they magnify and multiply a divisive and parochial mentality. But the part we can appreciate is that pervasive, irresistible human drive towards community in some form. It's always there. Community that can become a mob, yes. but also community that can become a congregation or a rally or a women's march or a movement that saves and holds. Some of you may be familiar with the renowned American philosopher Judith Butler, who does a lot of work on gender and identity and societal ethics. And her most recent book, which just came out, is called The Force of Nonviolence. The Force of Nonviolence. And in it, she makes this point. An ethics of nonviolence cannot be predicated on individualism and must take the lead in critiquing individualism as the basis of ethics and politics, unquote. That's kind of interesting. When we think about nonviolence, we often think about single leaders, right? Gandhi, and who learned from him? MLK, right? Great practitioners of nonviolence in the 20th century. But of course, what made them great wasn't that they did it so well, it was that they led communities of people. Because no one is self-sufficient. Because when we hurt anyone, we are hurting ourselves. And I mean that both ways. When we hurt anyone, we are hurting ourselves. In hurting them, we are hurting ourselves also. We are damaging ourselves with our will to hurt somebody else. But also, probably if we're hurting somebody in the first place, we were already hurting before we encountered them. Right? We were hurting ourselves, and so we hurt someone else, and in that further hurt ourselves. That's how immediate the cycle is. And we are interdependent. It's not just a principle. It is a principle. It's one of our principles. But it's not just a principle. It's not just an ideal. It is a reality that we have to address and honor in how we live. Was anybody else a Paula Poundstone last night by any chance? Yeah? Raise your hand. Who's a Paula Poundstone? I certainly was. There we go. So you will remember that she said this interesting thing about global warming. I thought it was such a great paradigm. She said it doesn't matter if one country does something great about global warming. Everybody has to do it because everybody's got to be in it together. We all have to be affected. If China does something great but the US and Europe doesn't, it's not enough, right? And then she said, it's like sitting in what used to be the non-smoking section on an airplane. Right? Such a great metaphor. Exactly the same. It doesn't matter if you're not smoking, because three rows back, somebody's got a cigar. We are interdependent. It is a reality we need to address and honor in how we live. It's a different way of understanding equality. And for Dr. Bauer, it also means that calmness, interestingly, is not the only foundation for nonviolence. She is thinking these days, what can be done creatively with rage? Collectively channeling rage, which a lot of people are experiencing daily, lately, with everything that's going on, in order to honor and central the equal value of all human lives, mutually interdependent. And also, not just the equal value of all lives, but what she calls the equal grievability, is her word, of all human lives. As Dr. Butler points out, if your life is understood as deeply grievable, then it will also be more powerfully livable with conditions that allow you to flourish. If you're the kind of person lots of people would grieve if something terrible happened to you, it necessarily makes you someone who also has a more livable life. And conversely, if your life is not valued as being deeply grievable, if or when wrong or evil is done to you, then it is not as livable. All along, you are more subject to racism or economic marginalization or genocidal violence or persecution. Individualism perpetuates the unequal grievability of different people by its very nature. Individualism perpetuates the unequal grievability of different people. Community at its best, healthy community, not small-minded village community, but large-minded congregation community. True beloved community that keeps itself relevant and compelling by its very nature, this kind of community grows. It is not perfect, but boy, we grow the equal grievability of all people. Because when we are in community with each other, we get to know each other. And when we get to know each other, we care about each other. And when we care about each other, we support and advocate for each other, which builds the world we dream about, the dream Dr. King dreamed. That's the village we believe in. And that is the nature of the children we are trying to raise. I remember when I used to be a lot more satisfied with life. Not with my life always, but with the larger life, capital L-I-F-E, that did indeed seem to be bending towards justice. And I hate that feeling now of living so unsatisfied, starving, and abraded. It is so abrasive to the soul. It's like someone has taken a giant emery board and kept rasping at the skin of my soul until it is raw and weeping and burns at the slightest touch. It hurts to live these days. And we are so tired of hurting and tired of being hurt. Every single one of us. And that is our anguish and our maladjustment and our dissatisfaction. It is the unbearableness of living like this, the unbearable heaviness of being. And these are the reminders that it is not right to live like this. It is not right, and that's why it feels this way. So thank God we can't bear it. Thank God we don't just bear it. Because bearing would mean simply hunkering down and getting used to it and lowering our expectations of ourselves and each other. We cannot be worn out or borne down by the suffering, heavy as it is. We cannot be worn out or borne down by what we feel and see around us and in us. We have to denounce it, and we have to fight it. And we have to remind each other about what life can still be like for us all, for everyone together. No fear. No pain. No persecution. No to the walls and the detention centers and the prison industrial complex and the regressive white supremacist vision, no institutionalized hatred, no institutionalized injustice, no, no, none of it, none of it. It is unacceptable. It is unacceptable. And our very souls, our abraded souls, tell us so. And so do our minds. And so do the great prophets from all times and places, including
Dr. King. They teach us that it is the wrongness of now that helps to point us to the rightness of tomorrow. Because if we can see it, we can bring it. We can still bring it. We can always bring it. Now I'm going to do this thing that always scares me, even though it works every time, which is that I'm going to keep talking to you, even though I'm going down the stairs and I can't see you anymore. But Dr. King was in a long line of prophets when he taught what he taught in the midst of those days. And we have to thank him for his courage and for walking us through that terrible time. That bleak and desolate midnight is what he said in that address. That bleak and desolate midnight. Even when he knew what it might cost him, he did not flinch. And so here we are in another bleak and desolate midnight. And we remember him. And so we cannot flinch. We can mourn him, and we always will, but we also have to claim the reality that the dream didn't die with him. And no one person, no matter how great, can ever save everyone. No one person, no matter how great, can ever save everyone. The people must save ourselves. And it's only when we look beyond the Savior to their message and become ourselves the messengers. Every one of us an apostle, committed and courageous that the people will be saved. I was at the gun control rally this week at the State House, and one of the gun rights lobbyists kept taking pictures of me really close up. And I kept thinking, why is he taking these pictures, and what is he going to do with them, and what is going to happen to me because he's taking these pictures of me in that weird way? And it was scary. And I thought, okay, it's going to have to be what it is, because the alternative is to walk away. And maybe something will happen, and maybe nothing will happen. But no matter what, I am not walking away from this fight. And they can take all the damn pictures they're going to take, and they will do what they do with them. We cannot flinch from the risks we need to take, and we cannot flinch from the work that we need to embrace and the joy that we need to hold on to. In the midst of all of this, the joy that we know and have to hold on to all the more strongly, and the illusions that we have to let go of, even when it's painful. The lessons that teach us about illusions and what we have to let go of. And we can't stop. We just can't stop. That's how we deal with the pain and the hurt and the injustice and the outrage, with resolution and with the strength of community, which says, when you are stumbling or tired, lean on me, pass your burden to me, rest and let me carry it, and I will do the same with you, because we trust each other and we're in this together. And that is the beauty of beloved community. That's what it means. Every time I say to you, beloved community, all of that is wrapped up in it. That's what I expect. That's what I offer. That's what we expect. That's what we offer. The beauty of this church in this hot mess of a time We won't despair or quit because we have each other. And together, we are an opportunity for change. And let me also just finish by saying that strength in numbers is not just about polls or demonstrations, though it is also about polls and demonstrations. And we certainly know the difference voting can make this year. But the strength that comes with numbers is about more than that, because not every year is an election year, but every year and every day we have each other. And that is the strength of numbers, the power of beloved community. Whether we are voting or marching or leaning or learning or praying, we have each other and we will journey together. And we will rest and help and lean on each other until we have leaned and journeyed and helped and walked ourselves and each other out of this bleak and desolate midnight and back on the path towards that bright dream that cannot be just a dream, that bright and glittering daybreak that will stay, that world that we will build if we hold together. We are here, and we are here together. We are here. We are here together. What if you say that with me? We are here, and we are here together. And can I now ask you, Yankees all, to turn and say that to somebody near you? We are here, and we are here together. Oh, you are so courageous. And now let's say it, please, loudly together. We are here, and we are here together. Well, then. Well, then. Look around well. Look around well. And look out. Look out, world. Because we have come so far already, and we are just getting started. Amen.